AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/insightful. That's oracle.com/insightful. oracle.com/insightful.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich and a crispy golden hash brown and your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah.
All for $6, all just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle. Available at your neighborhood Tim Hortons. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
Welcome to another BritFlix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Danny Houston. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stuart.
My pleasure, my pleasure. If my wife knew I was talking to the Axeman from American Horror Story on the Zoom call, she would tell me to get off now.
Well, as long as you're playing Jack, you're safe.
I found a brilliant playlist on Spotify called Noir, which is just all easygoing, sort of classic cinematic kind of jazz tune. So yeah, maybe I'm safe.
If you feel threatened, just play that.
Okay.
Play that playlist.
Well, look, we've not come on to talk about my Spotify playlist. We've come to talk about your new film, The Last Photograph, which you direct and star in. It's going to be available on digital platforms in the UK and Ireland from the 26th of April. And before we get into any detail about it, do you want to give people a brief synopsis to what The Last Photograph is about?
Yes, it's quite specifically and simply about a photograph that is lost or stolen, and the importance of this particular object to this man. The story is told out of chronology. And as the story proceeds, we find out why this photograph is important.
Indeed we do. The screenplay is written by Simon Astaire, who is a friend of yours, I understand, yeah?
Simon Astaire is a good friend of mine and remains a friend after making the film.
That was a good sign. So from that sense then, from people listening in, at what stage did you as the director get involved with the screenplay, and how much work did you and Simon do to get the screenplay to where you wanted it?
Yeah, well, Simon wrote the screenplay and the book simultaneously. The book is more linear. The screenplay plays with chronology and memory. When he offered the screenplay to me to direct, I was particularly interested in playing with time, and how I would approach that, using different film, video, digital, trying to create that tapestry without place cards or that you wouldn't interrupt the emotional flow as you start to piece these fragments, I suppose, together. I felt it was very eloquent the way that Simon wrote how the the photograph finally fades, and how those memories are still alive, even if the image is lost of this object. And also, I was interested in towards the end of the second act, beginning of the third act, bringing in archive footage, which for me, in a way, was symbolic to the sort of psychological difficulty that the character was having, the inability to accept the inevitable.
Yeah.
Where there's a point where the film becomes about an incident that actually did happen.
Yeah.
A deadly terrorist attack, yeah. Pan Am 103, a bombing over Lockerbie.
Yeah, I mean that's interesting. You mentioned about the news footage, because I felt like the use of archive footage did a lot of the heavy lifting for those who were either A, too young to remember it, or B, aren't familiar with it. I mean, I'm of a vintage that, you know, I vividly remember this moment in time. In fact, 2 years after the event, you know, a girlfriend of mine, she met someone on holiday and he came down. He was from Lockerbie. So it was like 2 years after the event, speaking to one of your peers who was from Lockerbie, and it was, you know, fairly seismic, as you can well imagine. But I felt your use of the archive footage did a lot of heavy lifting for the story to show the magnitude, yes, outside of the story of Tom.
Yes, 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 yes. That was important to me. Also important for me to approach it from a point of respect, and to actually film there in Lockerbie. And in a way, to take the same journey that the character takes, to film in the little chapel very close to where some of the pieces of the airplane fell, and for it to carry that one poignancy in combination with a story which is fiction. Finally, it's an amalgamation of two or three different stories that Simon Starr pulled from.
Yeah,
which is my character and my son. So there's a point where the film, I guess, like a ribbon, and hopefully successfully brings those two stories together.
Yeah, no, there's a definite rhythm to the film where obviously in the beginning we're establishing who he is and what's troubling him, and obviously the theft sort of explodes that out, brings it all out into the open. But it's the use of a backstory and a forward story becomes more of a dance the minute he's on the search, because then suddenly the memories that it's sparking,
yes,
in his mind become less like flashback and more like his crisis, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And those, I feel that we all, I guess, have objects or things that carry significance to us. But sometimes we can be hit by an object or a gesture without being prepared for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And how that awakens our memory and helps us with our grief, and hopefully the film is also has a sort of cathartic experience where we can personalize the experience that Tom is having with our own experiences of loss, it can be anything. It can be a sweater, it can be any article that we hold dear, and it's that it can also spark new memories.
No, for sure, and I think that the use of subtext in your film through looking at the minutiae is really clever. Obviously, the photograph being the central thing, but then even the bookshop has meaning because of why he opened it, which we learn.
Yes,
and obviously, and the jumper is just a Christmas present, and then it becomes an artifact. Then it becomes a gift for somebody else to. I mean, The putting it in the letter writing exchange and the putting the jumper in the envelope I mean, I'm embarrassed to say, I almost cried at that point, you know, and all you've got is a man putting a jumper in an envelope. But by that point, you're invested in the same meaning that he's placing on the jumper and hopefully what's going to happen when it's received, aren't you?
Yes, yes. And also the maybe a banal conversation or a conversation that doesn't necessarily carry any meaning, but when we see it in retrospect, we understand what it means, and it carries a whole new poignancy to it and meaning that the characters were not aware of.
The famous one I always think of is in terms of that use of an object is Jack Lemmon with the cracked compact mirror in Shirley MacLaine. Suddenly, the cracked compact mirror means so much more than just giving somebody something back.
Yes, you know. Exactly. And it's interesting how film can do that. How film can work in regards to memory and something which when you don't have the information can mean absolutely nothing, and later it carry great symbolism.
Yeah, and that's the visual media in a nutshell, in a way. How did you find the sort of shoot? I mean, it's interesting. Over the last few weeks, I've done a couple of period pieces on the podcast. So I've jumped from 1930s Britain. I've done 1970s East London. And now I'm doing 1980s. Now your story's rooted in late 1980s. What are the challenges there for a shoot in 21st century to do 80s? Because it's not that far away, but it's 30 That's years.
With a very small independent film like this, the big moments for us are like, you know, oh, we've got the tax disc for the car, and just finding the details, shooting up either low angle or high angle to miss whatever sins are in the way that give you away, and also. We filmed in Simon Astaire's father's house, who had recently died, and that house carried a lot of things from the past that were there that were just it had a haunting mood to it anyway. But a lot of the objects and articles there were of a time past. On a low budget film like this, it's really trying to find whatever is there. The stove was right, the refrigerator was right.
Got you. Right. Okay.
Yeah, that would have been impossible. That would have cost a lot of money. It would have been very difficult for us to set design that to bring those things in. So we had that. We rented the Jaguar. We shot in Battersea Park. That was pretty much the way it is now. I think one of the characters leans against a Henry Moore statue. The Christmas lights pretty much the same as they always are. The characters spinning on the sort of Ferris wheel. That might have been a bit of a cheat. I'm not quite sure whether that was around at the time. It looked and felt like the right image.
The way that you interweave the interdependent stories and the way, you know, the memories plus present plus the incident and stuff. Like I say, on that initial instance where you've lost the bag and you're looking for it, the image, the story that you're showing from behind begins to make more sense. And then what I thought was interesting in sort of change of tone and obviously to show where Tom's going was suddenly the use of sound design. In the drive to Scotland, it suddenly becomes more visceral. It's almost like it wasn't there up until that point. And then suddenly the sort of impending craziness of where he's heading is out on the road, and the sound design of the film really sort of magnifies that. So how did you sort of discover that sort of layer, as it were, for telling the story?
Well, Peter Rearborn, who composed the music, worked very close with our sound design editor, and they stole from each other a bit, and worked together musically, One of my notes to Peter, the composer, was a music box, just to be able to hear the rotation of the wheels, to hear the feet against the pedals and the piano, and to actually feel the instruments, and to try to do the same thing with the sound design, and to bring in the sounds of memory as well.
Yeah.
So it all very much based on memory. The first time that he loses the bag, it's almost like I feel it's almost a little bit of an homage to Nick Rogue.
Very much so.
searching for the red coat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then the film becomes quite so a little bit expressionistic. So it's very important. It was very important for me for music and sound design to work in harmony.
Now, obviously, you star in this and you're directing it, which is obviously two very different roles. One requires you to be in the moment, in the minutiae. Another one requires you to keep taking helicopter shots as well as be in the minutiae. So how do you, certainly, if you think at the start of a shoot, then what are you doing to sort of set a tone on a set where you're directing as well as starring in? Is there anything you want out of a set you're going to work on?
Well, one of the reasons I cast myself was because I knew I was available.
Do you check your ages first?
Yeah. I was able to shoot different periods of time. So I started the film really with just a Canon still camera, and I just shot the Christmas lights because I knew that Christmas would be over soon and the Christmas lights would be gone. So I started with that. And then we shot in Simon Astaire's father's house before the house was sold. So that was a crew and a group of people that we would never use again.
Right. Okay.
And then I shot during these different periods. So I was really able to stop and start, which was a luxury that one wouldn't have on a normal film because the crew and it was just, you know, could be changed was the crew was minimal. I could do that. And so that helped me in the sense as far as compartmentalizing.
Yeah.
And there were scenes that were happy scenes, like the scene where I'm driving my son to the airport. We don't know what's going to happen to him at the time. So there, it's a happy scene. So those weren't that demanding from an emotional standpoint.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some of the scenes, yeah, were tougher, but I would then go back home or wherever I was staying and look at the footage and it didn't become about my performance anymore. It became about, oh no, what's that in the background? Why there?
Well, that's interesting. It's interesting then you can establish that distance from yourself almost, which is quite surreal even saying it as a sentence. But, you know, because that's the scene certainly up in Lockerbie where you essentially are coming to grips with reality when you've driven up there in denial.
So,
yes.
Got some biscuits. You okay?
Yes.
Come on.
I've had enough tea. See, I've been here for hours. All I want to do is give this to my son. You understand?
You need to listen to me.
I'm listening.
There are no survivors. Do you understand me? No survivors.
No, I don't understand.
Look! Look! Help! Be help!
It's okay.
Huh? You're okay.
It's okay, sir. Come on. Can you hear me? Just breathe.
Yes.
Just breathe. Yes. Shh. Breathe. You're okay.
That's a real free emotional moment, isn't it? That's not something that just sort of, you know, it's not like you say the pleasant chats in the car are great. I mean, yeah, and it's yeah. And you get the impression of a father son. It's beautiful, you know. You feel that bond because, like, even I mean, I love the toffee wrappers doesn't make dad angry. You know, it's like it's a genuinely happy time. These people could spend more time with each other they wish, and then obviously it takes the turn for the worse. But But in terms of like take getting yourself ready to shoot a scene where you're having that emotional breakdown, as it were.
Yeah, I mean I had a wonderful Steadicam operator, and we the scene in the town hall where he brings a sweater for his son, and he's still in denial. That we set very few extras, we put up a, I don't know whether it was a 35 mil lens on the Steadicam, and it worked. The shot worked, but it seemed to be sort of floating a little bit through the actual scene. So I asked the Steadicam operator to put on a longer lens, and I think it might have been 55 or something like that, or maybe even longer. So he really had to focus in and make sure that everything was in focus, literally.
Yeah.
And it was a much harder move for him. But at that point, we'd done two takes on the wire lens, so he knew what my moves were. I knew where he was going to be, and we did this little bit of a waltz together. But it somehow threw the background out of focus, kept on me, and there was a sort of quality to it, which showed the man's loss of equilibrium, I guess.
I mean, we the audience almost fall over with him. It's like you, because the scene goes so tight.
Yes. And then the no survivors line, you know, just caught it as he goes over
yeah,
the shoulder.
Yeah.
I knew he'd got it. And that I was, and getting ready for my fall. And also what helps that shot a lot, I think, is the sound design. The lack of sound.
Yeah.
And the odd little bits that we hear, the spoon against the teacup. And those identifying those small sounds that I suppose you would identify if you were in that mental state, where everything's a bit, you hear things a bit fuzzy.
And also everybody else that's there would also still be in a state of shock. So there wouldn't be a lot of jibber jabber going on. And
that's right.
Like the usual kind of convivialness of a people coming together, it would be,
yeah,
what the hell is going on? So you're right, yeah.
So you've got all of that happening, and then two takes didn't really work. Then the third take, we got it. We got it. Oh, fantastic! I mean, I couldn't be happier. At that point, it's like the relief. The relief overcomes the tragedy that the man is going through.
I get you. Yeah. Now, You seem to use, I think almost like four different types of look and feel.
Yes.
There's the archive, there's the black and white, there's the present day, there's Luke's the son's memories, which are also in their own thing. So what was your conversations like with Ed Rutherford then in terms of cinematography? Because there's a lot to sort of cover. And like you say, it's not a big budget movie, so you haven't just got free rein.
No. Well, a lot of conversations about the 16 mil. Now, of course, one can make digital look like 16 mil easily. It's not that difficult, probably more efficient also to do it that way. But we found out that we could develop the 16 mil. It wasn't going to be an enormous, horrific cost. We could rent the 16mm camera. It was very much available. Nobody else was renting it, so we got a good deal on the 16mm camera, a little Arri. And what I felt was important to me, which is sort of the way I convinced Ed, was that there's a sort of formality with film. You film differently when you've got a film camera.
It's a finite resource, isn't it? It's a finite resource. Digital lasts forever.
You can feel the film burning through. You know, you feel that.
Yeah.
You feel that, especially in a low budget film. But also, you frame differently. It's you're not there's a sort of a formality about film. And also just, it reminded me of my old film school days when I went to the London International Film School, and that's what we used to film on. And it was just 80s. It meant 80s, early 80s.
Yeah, yeah, I never thought of that. Yeah, you're kind of retracing the steps yourself as well as for the film.
Yeah, so that with the wardrobe and the thing, and that just felt that we belonged to that period. So that I thought it was important for me that we do that. And the cost wasn't too bad. Then the we used a not very good Panasonic early digital camera for the bookshop stuff. We used a beautiful Alexa for the end material.
Mm.
When the second time he goes to Lockerbie with some gorgeous lenses on that. And the archive material was probably the most expensive.
Okay.
Out of everything, we really had to, every minute is costly. That was expensive, very, very important for me, and budgeted as an item before we even started filming.
Got you. I mean, because essentially you're turning documentarian there, aren't you, in a way? It's like you're melding a fictional narrative with reality, but also that reality is essentially what you would see in a documentary, isn't it?
Yes. There's, I was trying to have those two or all of those formats kind of bleed into each other without using place cards or any kind of indications to what period we're filming in. Hopefully to keep that emotional through line.
Yeah, because it was. I'm trying to. I think it's Norman Fowler, isn't it? The minister who talks. And that was a real sort of, that was like a flashback for me watching it. It's like, because you can see on his face, it's like, what the hell am I meant to say here?
Yes, absolutely. You can see how ashen his face is. And Alistair Stewart, who breaks the news, we hear him in the piece, and I remember hearing him at the time. So, a lot of these elements, which I kind of, I don't know, they kind of also remind me a little bit of neorealism about, you know, the films that I grew up with as far as like Rome, Open City, and films that actually use what's happening around them at that particular moment in time as a way to tell a story, which is also about one's environment.
Yeah, no, for certain. It's that was one of the things that before I sat down to watch it and reading the sort of what it's about, I wasn't anticipating that level of energy and sort of life in it, given the subject matter. But there's definitely, because it really is. It's almost like you could describe it. I mean, I've not thought about this till now talking to you, but you could describe it as a kind of second coming of age for Tom in a way.
Yes.
Where he ends the film, he's like, he's got a new life to lead.
Yes, he does. And in a way, I see her, Simon Astaire and I had long conversations about this. I'm not entirely sure if he agrees with me, but I very much feel that in a way, she's not real. The girl that turns up at the end is not real. She's in a way, she's a figment of his imagination, which helps him heal. And I use the word heal. I don't believe that time heals all wounds. We kind of know that not to be true. But there is a sort of cathartic experience that he has, and he invents her for himself. And when they walk up to the hill at the end, she literally does sort of disappear into another reality.
Mm.
The reality that he's inventing to help heal.
How do you, in the edit of this film then, with all the different media and the kind of blocking of time that you had to take to shoot it, which wasn't one long shoot, what was the rules of the game during the edit for you? How did you manage that one?
It was lots of cards on the editing room floor.
Yeah.
Mapping the trajectory of these different storylines. And one thing that we did that was quite interesting was, you know, he has the memory of his son, but his son also has his own memory. And there we're kind of breaking some sort of there's some sort of rule that we're breaking there. And we were able to, do it. And also, the girl that the boy is in love with, has her memories, which are stolen from the memories that the son originally had of her.
Well,
I talk it through and see. But when one sees the film, one can kind of maybe possibly understand what it is that I'm saying. But we.
No, you can. I'll reassure the listener. You can. That does make sense, what Danny just said.
Yeah, but we do break certain formalities that normally I don't think are broken film.
Yeah, because you're right. When you begin to think of things being real fiction, as in they're not real memories, but we're seeing them as they're played out, because we're being asked to imagine it happening.
Yes.
Then you can.
He's in a way, Tom is remembering his son's memories.
Yeah. I must admit, I like that the switch between the black and white and the color, which is his memory of talking to his son, and then. I was imagining that the colour bits was Tom remembering the stories his son had told him, and therefore he was just putting his son in an imagined version of it. It may not even be that accurate, but it's what he.
Yeah.
I mean, your film itself though is a lesson in the fact that memories don't die. The objects could go missing, but actually what Tom learns is his memory of his son will never die.
That's right.
Because, like you say, grief and time don't cancel each other out. And therefore, the memory of who you love can never go away either. That's not that you don't need an object to hold on to the love. The love will stay with you.
Yeah, no, that's well put, Stuart. Yeah, that's the point.
I have to ask. There's one little bit that I'm hoping wasn't a happy accident, and it was planned. When you're looking over the river, and there's the shot of you and the river in the frame. And then there's a life buoy ring comes into shot and then goes out of shot. That I was kind of reading a lot into that life buoy at that point.
That's an accident, and it was a lucky accident for us. And also at that moment he looks on to the other side of the river. On the other bank, and there's the statue of Buddha, where his son and the girl were sort of frolicking around there. Now, of course, he doesn't realize that's what he's looking at. We viewing the film know that that's where his son and the girlfriend were, but he doesn't. But somehow his gaze is taken in that direction. The same way. Sort of strangely, supernaturally, maybe. When he looks at the boy who's by the river, that look takes him to the bag that he's been looking for.
That was a very cinema moment. That idea of making a connect. We know where Tom's at. That kid's got no idea what he's looking at.
Yeah.
But obviously, we know what's going on. It captures quite a lot with very little. Going on, really, in a way. There was a motif, I think, that I saw you were using with Tom, and the first time I noticed it was in the bookshop, where he's basically telling why losing the bag's important.
What was in the bag, sir?
Tommy. Oh, sorry, am I interrupting?
Sorry, you are?
I own that restaurant. I'm a friend, rather I know, Mr. Hammond.
If I may continue.
Certainly.
The bag, sir.
£500 in cash for the damn plumber. Book. I guess it was paper. My keys. But I have an extra set. And, a photograph.
You basically just portrait him. Like, it's like a mid-shot portrait of him. And there's almost like a similar shot again when he's reading the book and he gets the news of the plane crash, except it's a view of him looking into his living room from outside, looking in. But each time it's like him centre portrait while something big's going on. And I thought, especially the bookshop scene, it was like suddenly here's a desperate man. He's clearly isolated, but he's in a tight bookshop and he's with two other people. But you feel in that little frame, his moment of isolation really strongly.
Yeah, yeah. And Sarita Chowdhury, I thought her performance was great because she's not completely, doesn't completely like him, and he doesn't completely like her either. Mm. There's a wonderful sort of dysfunctional quality that they both have,
yeah,
which makes them understand each other.
Mm.
And there's, you know, a point where she tries to help him, but he recoils. He doesn't want to be touched. But then finally, when he finds the photograph and he's able to tell her, rather excitedly, that he's found it, they touch for the very, very first time. It's a small little gesture, but leaves one with some hope for him, hopefully.
Well, I mean, Sarita's performance is brilliantly strong, and I just wonder, I mean, taking that character, casting her in the role, what did she do for the character of Hannah that maybe you didn't imagine on the page, that suddenly when your camera's pointing at her and she's being Hannah, you're like, that's the character I wanted to cast her as?
The challenge there, from her point of view, from the performer, was how to express her empathy for Tom's character, but also her own internal pain.
Mm.
There's a scene where he goes to her place to explain why he's behaving like such a curmudgeonly type character. And she allows him to explain, but we don't hear it; we see it. And then we cut to her reaction to what we understand, the information that we understand has been told to her. And she does very little. She looks out the window, and she understands. And then one of those moments is broken with, well, shall we have a drink?
Shall we get drunk?
Shall we get drunk? Which is, I feel so real, and it's really dangerous waters to navigate those, because you don't want to get overly sentimental. You want to respect what's happened, but you want her to understand what this character's been through. And then when he says to her, "Why are you being so nice to me?" She says, "Well, we share something." He says, "What is it?" She says, "Pain." That in itself is as far as dialogue and as far as what's on the page is so sparse and minimal. But I believe what's up on the screen is
yeah. Cause that's a loose thread that we're left. That's the thread we're left to imagine, aren't we? We're not.
Cause
in a way we don't know it. We see each other in the street. We don't know everybody. We don't know everyone's backstory.
Exactly.
And it's arguably that most people are carrying some, it's not always obviously a catastrophic terrorist disaster, but everybody carries a trauma of some description with them. And so your moods are not always dictated by what social decorum dictates.
Yeah.
It's sort of your mood can be, this is how I am now. And I thought that Hannah's character was this woman was almost like the world not giving up on Tom, rather than, you know, in a way she represented, there was a life to live for Tom. So
yeah,
let's not give up on him. And I thought that was really strong.
Yeah, right.
I think we should remind people then. So the last photograph is available from the 26th of April. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving us your time on the Britflix podcast.
Stuart, thank you. Enjoy talking to you. Enjoy talking about film.
Oh. Oh. Stole my bag. What? And robbed.
No.
Just a few more questions.
What was in the bag?
A photograph.
Well, Luca's going to New York.
New York?
Yeah. He's fallen in love.
It's not far. It's just across the Atlantic, you know.
Don't forget you're driving me to the airport.
I won't forget.
Pan Am flight PA-103, 255 people on board, has crashed just north of the Scottish border.
I've come to collect my son. He was on the Pan Am flight. I need to get this to my son. He's very cold. It's very cold.
You need to listen to me.
I'm listening.
There are no survivors.
I don't understand.
Look! Look!
The photograph. What are the chances that you might find it?
Thieves are only interested in the cash. The rest of the stuff they throw away.
I thought we were gonna spend the rest of our lives together. Not just those few short weeks.
If you need to talk.
A random act of theft sent me for a talisman. I bought him the ticket.
He was in love. He wanted to experience more of it.
I don't have the strength to face anything anymore. I wish I could mourn in peace.
I think the key is to live in the present.
To the present.
You're in my bookshop. You stole my photograph.
AI may be the most important new computer technology ever, but AI needs a lot of processing speed, and that gets expensive fast. Upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/insightful. oracle.com/insightful.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich and a crispy golden hash brown and your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah.
All for $6, all just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle, available at your neighborhood Tim Horton's. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.